Most people think corporate crime is like, you know, a bank heist. It's planned, it's obvious.
Right, you don't exactly accidentally slip and fall into a bank vault with a duffel bag.
Exactly. There are blueprints spread out on a table, burner phones, a getaway driver. You absolutely know when you are crossing the line into becoming a criminal.
The intent to commit a crime is undeniable. And, well, the physical boundaries are clearly marked by a big steel door.
Yeah, but then you step into the world of everyday office culture, and suddenly that clear line just completely vanishes. Welcome to today's deep dive.
Glad to be here.
Our mission today is uncovering how completely casual everyday office conversations, like just chatting with a peer or being helpful, can accidentally turn you into a federal criminal.
It is a really startling reality for a lot of professionals.
It really is. We're pulling our insights today from a fascinating set of compliance training scenarios put together by Excellus, focusing on antitrust and competition law. And the thing that strikes me immediately is that we aren't talking about shady backroom deals with briefcases full of unmarked bills.
No, not at all.
We are looking at scenarios involving frontline sales reps, HR directors, and business development teams who are just, you know, trying to be efficient or collegial. Okay, let's unpack this. Because the best way I can describe what we're looking at is that it's not a bank heist at all.
Right.
It's more like accidentally wandering across an invisible border and suddenly finding yourself subject to a completely foreign country's laws with no passport and absolutely no defense.
That is a great way to frame it. The landscape you are describing is governed by something called per se Sherman Act violations.
Per se, okay.
Right. And to understand why that invisible border is so dangerous, you really have to look at the history. The Sherman Antitrust Act was passed back in 1890. It was designed as a very blunt, very heavy instrument to bust up the massive Gilded Age monopoly.
Like the railroads and Standard Oil.
Exactly. The railroads, the sugar trusts. Because the government was dealing with such concentrated corporate power, the law established this per se rule.
And what does that actually mean in practice?
Well, in almost any other area of corporate law, to be convicted of a crime, the prosecution has to prove that your actions actually caused financial harm to someone.
Right. There has to be a victim.
Exactly.
Right.
But with a per se antitrust violation, no proof of competitive harm is required at all. The courts have basically decided that certain behaviors are so inherently destructive to a free market that the act itself is the crime.
Regardless of the outcome.
Exactly. Regardless of the outcome.
And what's terrifying in these Excellus scenarios is how little effort it takes to commit that act. We tend to think you need a signed, notarized contract to build a monopoly.
You really don't.
Yeah, the text emphasizes that a simple, casual verbal understanding between two mid-level managers over a cup of coffee is entirely enough to trigger a federal investigation.
Because the law does not care about formalities. It cares about the meeting of the minds. And the reality of antitrust compliance, which is what changes the temperature of this entire discussion, is the profound individual exposure.
Individual exposure.
Yes. When we talk about these violations, we aren't just talking about a corporate slap on the wrist or, you know, a massive fine paid out of a parent company's legal budget. We are talking about everyday employees facing federal indictment.
Wow.
We're talking about actual imprisonment, personal financial fines that can bankrupt a family, totally independent of whatever settlement the company might reach with the Department of Justice.
So the company writes a check and moves on, but the employee...
The corporation might survive the scandal, but the individual employee goes to federal prison.
Wait. I need to pause on that because it feels completely disproportionate.
Say no, it does.
If I'm just, say, a frontline sales employee, like a junior account executive, and I make a casual verbal agreement with a competitor without my boss ever knowing, without the CEO's signature, I'm the one facing federal prison.
Yes.
How does the liability not just roll up to the executives who actually own the business?
What's fascinating here is the sheer scale of the disconnect between what employees assume and how the law actually operates. The source material points out that the gap between the legal exposure employees carry and what they actually know is among the largest in all of enterprise compliance.
So people just literally have no idea.
Most sales, HR, and business development folks have simply never been told that their daily networking conversations carry individual criminal liability. The DOJ prosecutes the individual because you are the one who actively participated in the conspiracy.
That is wild.
And here's another terrifying detail for the uninitiated. There is no minimum financial threshold required to trigger the violation.
Meaning it doesn't have to be a huge deal?
Right. You don't have to be rigging a $1 billion government defense contract.
Mm.
If you illegally coordinate on a tiny regional $5,000 account, the per se rule applies with the exact same force.
Because the act itself is the crime.
Exactly. The law doesn't care if the deal was minor. It only cares that the invisible border was crossed and competition was eliminated.
Okay, so now that we understand the immense, really life-altering personal stakes here, let's put you, the listener, in the shoes of someone on the front lines. I want to walk through the underlying themes of these specific scenarios outlined in the text because they are frighteningly mundane.
They really are just everyday conversations.
Right. Let's start with the concept of carving up the map, what the legal world calls market allocation. Picture this. You're a sales rep. You're at a crowded industry conference, wearing the lanyard, drinking the terrible hotel coffee.
We've all been there.
Yeah. And you run into a competitor you've known for years. You're both exhausted. And you casually agree, hey, I'll stay out of your accounts in the Northeast if you stay out of my accounts in the Southwest.
It happens all the time.
On the surface, that just sounds incredibly sensible. It saves everyone time and travel budget, right?
Yeah. It feels like a brilliant survival tactic in a high-stress job. But legally, market allocation between competitors is a per se violation of the Sherman Act. By agreeing to divide territories or customers or even specific product lines, you have unilaterally eliminated competition.
You've basically played God with the market.
Exactly. The entire premise of a free market is that the consumer gets to evaluate multiple options and choose the best fit. When you carve up the map with a competitor, you have decided for the customer what their options are. You've robbed them of choice.
And it was just a conversation by the coffee urn?
And again, the DOJ doesn't care if it was an oral agreement made in a noisy convention hall. The moment you agree to stay in your lane, you have committed a federal crime.
So if carving up the map is illegal, what happens when competitors stay in the same territory but try to survive by manipulating the map? This is where the XLS training moves into price fixing. And the rationalization here is always, well, we all know we're undercharging.
Right. Everyone feels the squeeze.
Yeah, so the scenario puts us at a trade association meeting. These happen all the time. Everybody in the industry gathered to talk about broad macroeconomic trends. But then the formal meeting ends, people are grabbing a drink at the hotel bar, and the conversation drifts to the crushing pricing pressure everyone is feeling.
It's a very natural progression of a conversation.
Right. Someone sighs and says, you know, if we all just held the line and stopped undercutting each other, the market would reset to where it should be. And everyone nods. Nobody signs a contract. Nobody writes down a specific price target. Just let's hold the line.
The mechanism of the law here is incredibly subtle. Price fixing does not require agreeing on a specific number.
Really?
Yes. You don't have to say, we will all charge exactly $49.99 starting on Tuesday.
Yeah.
It only requires coordination that affects pricing.
Wow.
The moment competitors agree to a formula, to eliminate discounts, to set a price floor, or simply to hold the line against price drops, the coordination has occurred.
And that's all it takes.
Trade association meetings are actually highlighted in the source as the most common venue for these exact types of violations, simply because it's the one place all the competitors are physically in the same room. The environment breeds a false sense of safety.
Because everyone's wearing a name tag and having a beer. Okay, let's take it a step further. What if the customer specifically asks you to compete in a formalized way, like a request for proposal, an RFP?
That's a huge area of risk.
Yeah. In the training materials, there's a scenario about bid rigging.
Yep.
You receive a massive RFP. A competitor calls you up and says, hey, we both got this RFP. Let's be real. It's a coin toss. The buyer is just fishing for numbers. You take this one and we'll take the next one that comes down the pipeline.
Which is incredibly common in certain industries.
It's like playing a game of poker where you and another player are secretly showing each other your cards under the table just to ensure the third player loses all their chips.
Yeah.
You are creating the illusion of a fair game, but the outcome is predetermined.
That is an incredibly accurate way to describe the mechanism of the crime. Activities like bid rotation, which is taking turns winning, or complementary bidding.
Wait, what's complementary bidding?
That's where you intentionally submit a bid you know will fail just to make the process look legitimate. Or bid suppression, where you agree to withdraw a bid entirely. These are aggressive criminal acts.
And the penalties are steep.
Very. The text drops a very heavy statistic here. Engaging in bid rigging carries an individual prosecution risk of up to 10 years in federal prison.
10 years. Just for saying, you take this one, I'll take the next.
10 years. And the reason the penalty is so severe, going back to the macroeconomic impact, is that you are actively defrauding the entity requesting the bid. Over time, bid rigging completely destroys market trust.
Yeah, I can see that.
It artificially inflates costs for buyers, which is especially devastating when those buyers are municipalities, schools, or hospitals relying on taxpayer dollars.
Man, it makes complete sense that aggressive sales tactics and bid manipulation draw federal fire. But the deep dive gets even more unnerving because it's not just the front office sales teams that fall into these traps.
No, not at all.
Let's pivot to the back office, because simply managing a workforce or checking your inbox can trigger these exact same laws. The source material details a massive blind spot around labor constraints, specifically no poach agreements.
This is a huge focus for the DOJ right now.
The scenario goes like this. An HR lead at a competitor reaches out and says, look, we're killing each other trying to hire the same specialized engineers. Let's agree to stop recruiting from each other's teams. Let's just extend a little professional courtesy.
Right.
Now, I have to jump in and play devil's advocate here. From a business perspective, high turnover destroys institutional knowledge. It costs a fortune to onboard people. Isn't an HR director just protecting their company's survival by trying to stabilize a chaotic workforce? Why is the government criminalizing a manager who's just trying to stop the bleeding?
It sounds like responsible management. I grant you that. But you have to look at the macroeconomic harm. A no-poach agreement is essentially market allocation.
Just like carving up the map.
Exactly. But instead of allocating customers, you are allocating human beings. By agreeing not to compete for talent, you are artificially suppressing wages. You are restricting the free movement of labor.
Because the engineers don't even know this agreement exists.
Right. If an engineer cannot leverage an offer from a competitor, their earning potential is permanently stunted by a secret agreement they didn't even know was happening.
Oh, wow. That is grim.
The source specifically notes that the DOJ has been criminally prosecuting no-poach agreements since 2021. The enforcement landscape has shifted dramatically, moving beyond just consumer pricing and putting HR departments directly in the crosshairs for labor market manipulation.
Which brings us to perhaps the most anxiety-inducing scenario for anyone who uses email. The hot potato.
The hot potatoes, yeah.
Imagine you are sitting at your desk and you get an email. You open it and realize a competitor has accidentally emailed you their highly confidential internal pricing deck for the upcoming quarter.
Just right there in your inbox.
You didn't ask for it. You didn't hack their servers. It literally just landed in your lap because someone typed the wrong name in Outlook. The information is incredibly useful. The temptation to just quietly look at it is astronomical.
The legal theory at play here is called knowing receipt, and it is incredibly dangerous. You might not have asked for the information, but the law cares intensely about what you do next.
So reading it is the crime.
Well, if you read that pricing deck and then participate in setting your own company's prices, the DOJ assumes your decision-making process is now tainted. You cannot selectively unknow your competitor's future pricing.
Right. You can't just pretend you didn't see it.
Exactly. If you forward it to your sales team, or if you adjust your own strategy based on what you saw, you have instantly created trade secret and antitrust exposure. The accidental nature of receiving the email does not immunize you from the intentional nature of how you use it.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me, though. We've gone through these different themes, you know, carving up territories, fixing prices, rigging bids, freezing labor markets, and handling leaked info. And every single one of them involves smart, capable professionals.
They're really educated people.
Yeah. So why are they falling for this? When you look closely at the scenarios, every single one comes with a built-in, completely logical rationalization. Professional courtesy. We all know the market is broken. They sent it to us.
Right.
It feels like the real enemy here is our own psychological conditioning. Mm-hmm. We are wired to be agreeable, rational human beings in the workplace.
We really are. We are deeply socially conditioned to seek consensus. We want to reduce friction, and we want to find mutually beneficial solutions.
It's just human nature.
Exactly. When someone offers a professional courtesy, our immediate human instinct is to reciprocate. The Excellus training recognizes that you cannot rely on a list of rules or just, you know, the fear of prison. You have to target the underlying psychology.
How do they do that?
They introduce a concept called the decision readiness engine. The philosophy is that you have to train a counterintuitive reflex. You have to catch the rationalization that makes the violation feel reasonable in the moment before the agreement is established.
Okay, so how does that psychological reflex actually work in practice? Because if my instinct is to smile and nod with the person standing in front of me at the hotel bar, how do I stop myself before I cross that invisible border?
It requires building pure muscle memory. You have to recognize the moment the conversation crosses the line, the second you hear phrases like hold the line on pricing or stay out of my territory.
Your alarm bells need to ring.
Immediately. And this is the critical legal mechanism you have to understand. Silence can legally be interpreted as consent.
Wait, really? Does not saying anything?
Yes. The law recognizes a concept called conscious parallelism, or an implied conspiracy. If you sit in a room while competitors discuss fixing prices, and you say nothing, but later, your company's prices mysteriously match theirs.
A jury can infer that you agreed.
Exactly. A jury can infer that your silence was actually an agreement to join the conspiracy.
So you can't just quietly stare at your phone and pretend you aren't listening.
No, you absolutely cannot. You have to exit the conversation immediately and visibly. You have to unequivocally state, I cannot discuss this, and physically leave the room.
Hang up the phone, walk away from the coffee station.
Yes, you must break the implied conspiracy. And then you have to report it to your legal department that exact same day.
You're essentially building an alibi. You need a documented paper trail proving that you rejected the overture and escalated it.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this explains why compliance training cannot just be a box you check at the end of the year. The training must happen before industry conferences or bid processes.
So because you can't unring the bell.
Right. Once the casual agreement is made, once you nod your head at the hotel bar, the crime is committed. The employee must be decision-ready, equipped with that verbal and physical reflex before they ever put on a conference lanyard.
Okay, let's take a breath and bring all of this together. We've covered a lot of ground today and, frankly, some deeply unsettling realities about corporate life.
It is a lot to process.
It really is. To summarize this deep dive, antitrust violations are rarely about mustache-twirling villainy in a boardroom. They are about casual conversations, unwritten agreements, and incredibly dangerous rationalizations. The desire to be polite, to be efficient, to stabilize a workforce.
Good intentions paving the way to federal court.
Exactly. And those totally natural human instincts can carry up to a decade of personal prison time and massive fines because of the draconian nature of the Sherman Act. So what does this all mean for you?
It's a wake-up call.
It means it is time to seriously evaluate your own casual network and your daily interactions. The next time you are at an industry conference, or the next time you get a weird, misdirected email from a competitor or someone offers a professional courtesy, you need to remember the per se rule.
The invisible border is always there.
You need to remember that your intent to just be a good coworker or to save your company money doesn't matter to the Department of Justice.
This raises an important question, and it's something I think everyone needs to deeply consider after reviewing this material.
Let's hear it.
If the law doesn't care about your intentions and requires absolutely no proof that anyone was actually harmed, how many friendly understandings currently exist in your own industry that are just waiting for a Department of Justice spotlight?
Oh, man.
When you talk to your peers at competing firms, are you just networking? Or are you accidentally building a cartel?
That is a chilling thought to leave on. Are you networking or are you accidentally building a cartel? Remember, corporate crime isn't always a bank heist with a clear master plan. Sometimes it's just wandering over an invisible border because the person on the other side seemed really friendly. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Stay sharp, watch what you agree to, and we'll catch you next time.